It is Friday, June 1st, 2012. This is Deanna Spingola, and this is our special no frill radio program. We don't have any callers, we don't have a board operator, we don't have any commercials. It's just plain information, and that's the best kind of program to have. Soon after the establishment of the UN and the CIA, our traditional values, stable marriages, and morality rapidly begin to decline, while crime, drug use, divorce, promiscuity, pornography, and perversion accelerated. Family destabilization is not happenstance, but is very deliberate plan. The Rockefeller Foundation funded the research efforts of the decadent Alfred Kinsey, whose junk science continued the family-destroying moral metamorphosis of America. The American Law Institute's model penal code further enhanced Kinsey's work. In 1923, members of the American Bar Association founded the American Law Institute as an educational division. The Rockefeller Foundation, not surprisingly, also funded the development of the model penal code. The penal code decreased criminal accountability for criminal predators, I'm just tongue-tied today, engaging in serious crime against women and children. With that, our guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are VeraIconaPublishers.org, and please visit her YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/VeraIcona100. Great, great videos there, audio files. Please visit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
Good.
Excellent.
I gave that little introduction because, you know, we just we never talk about America when we're talking about all of these things, such as the moral decay and whatnot. And it just seems like, you know, we have it institutionalized here, and yet using that old projection that that people do, they always look at the worst possible human being on the planet. Or at least that's what they attribute to him. They always look at Hitler and attribute everything that they have done to him. When in fact, whatever you're talking about, whether you're talking about eugenics, whether you're talking about propaganda, you know, Americans did it first, the Jewish people did it first, and then what they do is they turn around and they say, oh, look what they did in Germany.
Exactly. Exactly. So we'll go over, it was actually sent by a listener, a short essay on Project Monarch, Nazi mind control. Well, the problem is the entire essay is about the United States and the CIA's experiments. And what this author is trying to do is tie it to Hitler and Joseph Mengele, when there is in fact no evidence at all that Mengele did such experiments, and that right there explains why he was not fervently tracked by U.S. authorities after the war. I believe the German intelligence agency knew where Mengele was. They certainly knew where Eichmann was, and they would not disclose that to the Americans. So I say good for Germany on that, because those two did not do anything. All of these twin experiments, the I die, all that nonsense, there is not a shred of factual evidence to prove that any of that went on. And according to Friedrich Berg, he went through the experimental data in the National Archives, still written in German. It has not been translated yet, I don't think. And he said that he went through, you know, all the data they had on the various experiments that were conducted and documented. And I don't know if Mengele in particular was part of this. I believe he was. It was basically for parachuting. They wanted to find out how altitude affected the human body. When a person parachutes out at a certain height, they lose consciousness. When do they regain it? That kind of stuff. All of the prisoners who were involved in this, from what we can tell from the documentation, were volunteers who would have their sentences commuted for volunteering, and there is not one person recorded to have died from these loss of consciousness experiments.
Amazing.
Right. And I'm sure that Mengele or other scientists involved in this disclosed to the patients volunteering that there was potential for injury or death.
And yet the prisoners volunteered. They knew what they knew that it was risky, and yet they did it anyway.
Right, and they wanted their sentences commuted. So more than likely, these were criminals or communists or people who had serious charges against them.
Right,
and that was it. There, the blue dye eye experiment thing. I read about that in, and the violin stopped playing. It is a fiction novel written by, I believe his name is, his last name's Mirga. I can't remember the first name. It's allegedly a gypsy author that wrote this fiction novel. He claims to have met with Mengele. Mengele had this special relationship with gypsies and loved them and protected them for some bizarre reason. And he had eyeballs sitting on the table one day when Mirga was at the camp. Oh, I saw eyes on the shelf. Oh, it was horror. And there was dye injected into them. Like Mengele's casually cruising through the camp, showing him this array and going, oh, yeah, those are my eye dye experiments. Isn't that neat? I mean, this insanity, that's why it was categorized as fiction.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing that we hear about Mengele is that he was the one that was waited for the trains to come in, and then he would say, okay, to the left or to the right.
Wasn't, right.
Yeah.
The angel of death. It's just so nonsensical. Yeah, that kind of nonsense. All Mengele was involved in was like taking blood samples and other things because he was a pioneer of genetics studies, which was like a breaking science back then. They knew very little about how genes affected behavior, looks, even culture. And that was, you know, a new and cutting edge area of science that mostly the British really pioneered it. And the Germans kind of jumped on that whole eugenics thing.
Right.
But that's all it was. It was really trying to understand how the genes of certain races, certain individuals affect eye color, that kind of stuff. That's all he was doing.
Right.
And of course, we've learned from Eric Hunt that Irene Cisblatt, one of our favorite Holocaust survivors, she had blood taken by that evil Mengele. He nearly gassed her. I mean, all this nonsense.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, we can pretty much discount all of these Holocaust survivor accounts simply because they're so outrageous.
Sure. Now, didn't he somehow remove her tattoo?
Yeah, and then he removed her tattoo, and she doesn't know why.
Yes.
It's just one of those strange Nazi mysteries.
You know,
the Nazis were real weirdos.
The fact that they had doctors at the death camps should raise a question to begin with. I mean, why would they have a doctor and also an infirmary and a hospital and all the rest? I mean,
right. It does beg the question. Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's the occasional slip up on the part of many of these supposed eyewitnesses of all this horror. Where they will admit that there were so many new births in the death camp that it was overcrowded.
Yes.
So wait, why are babies being born in a death camp? I mean, come on.
Yes.
It's incredible. So that's pretty much all I have to say on Mengele's alleged involvement in this whole CIA MK Ultra nonsense. I mean, to try to pin that on the Germans,
well,
one would probably have more validity pinning it to communist research, because as we know, Pavlov was Mr. I'm going to condition these dogs to salivate to my bell.
Yes.
And that was all used on the Red Army.
Oh.
That knowledge.
Really?
Yeah. The psychiatry and the psychology that was spearheaded by the communists was certainly used in the military realm, in interrogation process, all of that. It was implemented during the Cold War. And this is really why the CIA and the United States started doing pretty much the same thing to counteract that and to win the quote-unquote Cold War. And what's interesting is our friend Lewis Kiltzer, the author of Churchill's Deception, he mentions that the Cold War actually started with the Rudolf Hess affair because Stalin realized he had been lied to and undermined completely by his fellow allies. Churchill was making sure not to assist the Soviet war effort at all, even against the protestations of FDR, who was Mr. Stalin, practically. I mean, he was Stalin's, just, that was his idol, really. It was right. Kind of twisted relationship there. But Churchill, oddly, did everything in his power to prevent aid from getting to Stalin, even though the man was begging. And the reason being is because Churchill wanted to make sure that Germany and Russia were both completely smashed as much as possible so that Britain could swoop in and inherit the world.
Yes, because yeah. that was their goal. That was their objective.
Exactly. So there's your Cold War CIA MK Ultra. You know, why not attribute it to British policy and then, of course, the United States' battle with communism?
Right. And it was also, the Cold War was also devised in order to build up Israel militarily.
Oh, yeah. Right. It had many different functions. But yeah, the communists were really the founders of modern psychiatry psychology. One can find all of those experiments and stuff conducted in the USSR.
Yes.
So I'm not sure why we want to keep pinning it on Mengele, who was just a geneticist. Or Hitler, who really thought that psychology was kind of a nonsensical science.
Right. Well, you know, when Freud developed it, he did so in order to make money. Mm-hmm. A friend of his, a doctor friend of his, passed away. And some of his fellow students were very distraught over it. And he realized, oh my goodness, I could just talk to these people and it'll make them feel better. And the other thing that it does is that it takes away people's inhibitions. Like if you go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and they can say, oh no, everybody feels like that. Oh, sure. No, you don't have anything wrong with you. That's normal.
Right.
And so it has really changed our culture.
Mm-hmm. Right. And a lot of this article is based on kind of the speculative area of psychiatry and psychology. Is there really such thing as dissociative disorder, multiple personality disorder? There are many researchers who claim that it is nonsense, that it is so rare and you cannot empirically prove that it even exists. There are huge problems even with that. So, you know, we have to be a little bit careful in assuming that all of these people who come forward and claim that they were, in fact, victims of the CIA and whatnot and MK Ultra were, in fact, that's extremely difficult to prove, not only that they were did victims, which is dissociative disorder, but is it real? I've done a little bit of research, like in my year of doctoral studies on multiple personality disorder. And unless there are physiological changes and mental changes associated with the different alters, somebody can easily fake it.
I'm sure they could.
Yeah. So these are some of the problems associated with that. And this article relies so heavily on the testimony of the alleged victims. Now, some of them are certainly real, but I'm sure there have been many imposters as well.
Well, I mean, it gets you some, notoriety. It gets you on TV. It gets you on the Oprah show. If you talk about something that happened to you. And, you know, everybody else is doing it. And look, it works for them. So let's do it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And now just going through some of the aspects of this article, the individual who wrote it starts with kind of the mystery religions of Egypt, Greece, India, Babylon, all this stuff. He mentions Adam Weishaupt, and I thought that was interesting because he calls him a Bavarian Jesuit who was commissioned by the House of Rothschild to centralize power, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, as we know, Rothschild is Jewish. That's a Jewish family, Jewish dynasty. 1776, that's coinciding with the French Revolution, the whole Enlightenment that occurred in Europe, which was basically the beginning of the destruction of monarchy, which is traditional European or quote-unquote Aryan government, in favor of Freemasonic republics, where the publics allegedly vote and control the means of power and production, which is, as we know, nonsense. But he really wasn't a Bavarian Jesuit. He may have started out that way and ultimately used Catholicism as his cover to undermine the church.
Well,
but,
actually, he was trained at a Jesuit school. He was never actually a Jesuit.
Right. Okay, so we need to be careful in saying this man believed in the Catholic order and principles. No, he didn't. He was a committed Freemason. And many sources assert that he was Jewish.
Right.
No one has actually proven that. So I don't want to go out on a limb and say he was for sure Jewish. But Dieter Schwartz covered that. So, you know, that's in that Freemasonry pamphlet. All of this stuff, the Germans, the NSDAP exposed this mystery religion nonsense and the agenda of the Masons. So his foundation right there is undermined.
Yes. That is such a good little book. Oh, I just love
it,
that book.
It's excellent. I've read it like 3 or 4 times because every time I read it, something new pops up that I didn't notice before. But people really need to read that because the NSDAP busted into these lodges, including B'nai B'rith, which is revealed in a Time magazine article, which we now have on the site, the full article. And they grabbed all these documents, had their research department in the SS assess these, put them together in these short pamphlets and put this out for the people in the SS to read so that they knew what they were fighting and how they were being subverted through this careful republic, democracy, liberty, equality, fraternity, masonry.
Right.
So why would they expose their own foundations? That to me doesn't make sense.
Of course not.
I mean, the United States certainly wasn't going, hey, we have an official publication on masonry here and we just busted into B'nai B'rith and the ADL. That didn't happen.
No, sure didn't.
Right. And it still has not happened. The ADL has protected status here, as we know.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's the whole purpose of the ADL is to cover everybody's, you know, culpability and cover all of their, you know, lies and deceits and crimes and secret societies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. So if anybody wants to consult that Freemasonry book, it's on page 16 where he talks about Weishaupt and exposes him and their whole agenda. And then it goes on with a section, the Anglo Alliance, and he says Kurt Levin, a German psychologist, now that sounds like a Jewish name right there.
It is, yes, definitely.
Became the director of the Tavistock Institute in 1932. About the same time, Nazi Germany was increasing its research into neuropsychology, parapsychology. No, 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 wait a minute. Hitler wasn't appointed until 33, people.
Yes.
You have your years a little off. Now, he does not say whether Levin was dismissed upon Hitler coming to power, but I'll bet he was.
Oh, yeah.
Or he was certainly relegated to a position of no power. That just, I can't see Hitler going along with a Jewish German psychologist as the director of a certain institute.
Right.
Unless this Jewish scientist was doing like really important cancer research or something, they did not get to keep those posts.
Right. So, that was the whole point of the Jews being so angry at Hitler. All these people were losing their position. And I mean, he had a right to do that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, that's one of those things where it's like people hate him for doing that and they hate him for allegedly not doing that, like to Otto Warburg, for instance, because Warburg was able to keep his position as a prominent cancer research person. So, you know, he was allowed to stay in that position. He was actually appointed before Hitler came to power, but on Hitler's direct permission, he was allowed to stay there because Hitler was convinced that his research was very important, and he didn't want to just throw a German in there simply because.
Right.
So that was one instance of an exception. But in psychology and stuff, I don't think so. So somebody can certainly look into this Kurt Levin, but there was no Nazi Germany in 1932. There were NSDAP officials in the Reichstag that had been elected to the Reichstag, but they were not in control of the government in 32.
Right.
So that's just nonsense right there. He goes on with that Lebensborn myth, and this Lebensborn thing will not die.
No.
This has been covered in the Union Jackal, starting on page 116, because it's so important to undermine the nonsense associated with that. He believes, as the author of this article, that Himmler was in charge of a scientific project called Lebensborn, which simply means wellspring of life, which was about selective breeding, adoption of children, including large numbers of twins, and that they were going to create an Aryan super race that had total allegiance, a bunch of mindless minions, to the Third Reich New World Order, he says.
Right. Now, wasn't there a movie about that? Oh, I
can't. Is it Boys from Brazil?
Yeah, Boys from Brazil.
Yeah.
And there was a book.
That was on the other day. My dad's like, you got to check out Boys from Brazil. Watch this. You know? I'm like, I can't stand that stuff. I can't watch it anymore. It's just, I know better.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. As the author Siegfried Egel wrote for the Barnes Review, and they deserve full credit for this because their English translation is very good. They were not baby factories. They were not SS bordellos. It was not breeding farms for the master race. It was literally Lebensborn EV, and the EV in German stands for Registered Association, Eingetragene Verein in German. And basically all it was a system of lying in hospitals for pregnant women. Now, the reason it got the Aryan thing in there is because one did have to prove one's ancestry to take advantage of the facilities. So they didn't want foreigners or non-Germans being able to take advantage. And it was paid for by the SS. They had to give a little stipend of their, you know, weekly or biweekly, whatever their paycheck was. They gave a little stipend towards it because they were really first and foremost among those who could take advantage of these lying in hospitals. That's all it was.
What about the birth rate, and why did Hitler want to increase it? I mean, there's a very valid reason.
Well, sure. Not only were, first of all, Himmler's biggest concern, and probably Hitler's as well, was the Russian birth rate. You know, Himmler's looking over here going, for every one of our boys, there's three Slavic Russian boys. This is a huge problem simply from the balance of power in the world perspective. If Germany wants to be a world power, back then the thinking was the greater your population numbers, the more likely you are to have that kind of world power. Look at Britain's population. They had taken in more than 400 million simply because they had India and all those colonies. It bolstered their power, also the territory that went along with bigger numbers. So there was a very calculated reason for wanting to expand not only the territorial reach of Germany back to her ancestral lands, but to take in some population with that, which would be the Germans that were dispersed throughout Europe.
And hadn't, during the Weimar Republic, hadn't the population decreased? Hadn't the birth rate decreased?
Yep, absolutely. And as we can see today in any first world nation, if one does not maintain one's numbers in concordance with capitalism's growth and expansion, then you have to bring in immigrants. There is no other choice. So our choice is, are we citizens going to have children and make up for our numbers and expand ourselves, or are we going to bring in immigrants from all over the world?
Right.
That was Hitler's choice too.
Right. And we see it here in this country with after abortion was okayed by the Supreme Court, you had, you know, 56 million, just about 56 million people that aren't here because of that, that decision. And, you know, how can a country just maintain itself and maintain the, as you say, the capitalist, obligations and things?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're going to have a global capitalist order, and it seems that pretty much until very recently, this we may be in the midst of a worldwide cataclysm for capitalism. I think that Dennis's predictions are finally coming to pass, simply because capitalism cannot continue to grow. It just, the unsustainable qualities of exploitation of Earth, etc., are just, we're almost hitting the wall. But up until this time, we've all bought into this capitalist expansion thing. We got to go global. Well, if you're going to buy into that, then you have to act accordingly and have policies accordingly.
Right.
So, you know, immigration is part of that. Germany is running into the same problem. They are negative population growth right now. So is Japan. What are they going to do?
Right.
Fizzle and perish? Are we all going to kind of collectively decide to start limiting our populations and become more sustainable? There is some merit to the desire of certain elites to want to do that, because the more and more people we have, the more problems we're going to have. So, you know, I can personally see why they want to start having more sustainability. The problem is getting the publics of all these countries to buy into it. I mean, we constantly see China being attacked for its population limitation policies, but I think we need to ask, what are they supposed to do?
Well,
continue to allow their people to have as many children as they want. There are huge problems with that, as we can see.
Of course, I think that overpopulation is kind of a myth. Because when you go through, travel through some of these countries that are said to be overpopulated, you see all this vacant land. I'm talking about millions of acres of land. They're just totally empty. I mean, just even going across the United States.
Right, flying in a plane.
Yeah, I mean,
they're allegedly all concentrated in certain areas.
Yeah, in your urban, you have a lot of concentration in big cities,
right.
Which goes along with Agenda 21. So, you know, when you're talking about, I believe that there is enough resources. I think that it's a matter of the people who want to control those resources, and in order for them to control them, they want to have more than what they need and just decide that, you know, those useless eaters, well, we certainly don't need to share all of our resources with them. So it's I think that's part of the Agenda 21 and part of this getting rid of a lot of people. So it'll be more for them.
And that may well be. The thing is, though, is how they allocate the resources. Like you say, overpopulation, or what they say is not a problem if we do not allocate resources according to capitalism's need.
Right.
I mean, if one goes to Las Vegas and sees the waste of water there, it's insane. It's insane.
My word.
You don't build a city in a desert.
Amazing.
Idiocy, that kind of idiocy that capitalism propels. That's really the problem, is resource allocation and overexploitation. And the way they do it, you know, the oil companies poisoning water. Well, we wouldn't have a water shortage if you weren't poisoning all the water with your oil exploitation process.
Sure.
Fracking, these kind of things.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, really and truly, capitalism is really to blame for the overpopulation, quote unquote, problem. Yeah, we really wouldn't have an issue if it was just human beings getting by on their basic needs.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
and
so.
the capitalists have gone into numerous countries, you know, Vietnam and the Philippines, and they are so destructive. I mean, where the local populations have, for instance, in mining gold in the Philippines, they used natural methods. They didn't bring in caustic solutions and you know, have these toxic chemicals and stuff go into the water supply, and then you end up killing the cattle downstream, and then that leads to something else, and then the water goes into the ocean there, and it destroys the, you know, so many other things. I mean, you know, seeking profit can be a very dangerous thing and a very destructive thing.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's ultimately what the problem is. you know, is the allocation exploitation of resources, and that does limit the availability of things for a growing population.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Right. Okay, so going on with this, he mentions Operation or Project Paperclip. Okay, so some NS scientists who were leaps and bounds ahead of the Anglo-Saxon countries, for the most part, were kidnapped and offered at least a semi-private, decent living after the war if you come work for us. This is really the Mars thesis here, Jim Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Among others, Farrell in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Well, you know, if you kidnap people and you basically are doing what we call a plea bargain, okay, you can live a decent life. We're not going to prosecute you in our psychotic IMT trial if you come work for us. How does that mean that the evil Nazis were really the subversive agents that created NASA and all these experiments? And first of all, what role? No one has actually ascertained what role these Germans played in this research process. Were they actually administering electroshock? Were they the founders of electroshock therapy? Did they have a research paper written on its potential? They don't tell you any of that. They just say Nazi scientists brought in under paperclip, started the CIA and MKUltra through their insane concentration camp methods.
Right.
And which are all fake.
Right. Now, this article that you're talking about, it's called Project Monarch Nazi Mind Control by Ron Patton.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, it is a typical thing that they write about this. You know, they talk about, oh, you know, they used, you know, all of the things that they used in the concentration camps, and they had fluoride, and they did this, and they did that.
Yeah. But there's no proof. Yeah. I mean, one can just get The Holocaust Made in Russia by Carlos Porter. It's still available on Amazon, and it's going to be brought back into print, according to Porter himself. It's all in there. The source of all the insanity, where they had Soviet POWs run up a tree 500 times until they collapsed dead. All that nonsense. You know, he's exposed it all. And much of this comes from the Soviet accusations at the IMT trials.
Wow.
So, you know, we have to have a discerning eye, read with a grain of salt anything that comes from the Allied side. Unfortunately, because the Allies lied through their teeth.
They sure did.
And they plea bargained a lot. You know, this is how Ostplan was started, which is also covered in the Jackal. Von dem Bach-Zelewski is the source of Ostplan. How did they get it? Plea bargain. You tell us what we need to hear about Slavic extermination, 30 million. That's the figure we want to shoot for. We let you go. That's what happened.
Yeah. So they either tortured people to get what they wanted.
Correct.
Or they
Rudolf Hirsch.
Yes.
Huh.
Yep. Or they promised them, you know, something that would benefit them. And,
right. Right. And certain individuals were willing to do that, to quote unquote sell out, to be able to at least live on after the war.
Or have their family not be killed, or
exactly.
Some other thing.
Exactly. And the high cost of vengeance, is it Frida Uthly? I think it's Frida Uthly.
I think
Uthly.
So. Yeah. I
One
have
can
that book.
Still get that. That's an excellent book, because she went over there. She's bilingual, German English, went over there on a government sponsored study and said, wow, this IMT process, I'm shocked. She was disgusted by it. She said, this isn't justice. In fact, in another 50 years, we're going to be paying the piper for this, how we extracted this information. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. So she ends up exposing the United States' terrible policies for extracting confessions. And there was implication going on where they said, tell us the names we want to hear. It was Hirsch, wasn't it? It was Rudolf Hirsch, wasn't it? Yeah, you can get somebody to finally go, yes, it was Hirsch, he did it. So then they go to Rudolf Hirsch and they destroy the man. They All torture right. him to get the proof. that he killed many millions all by himself, supposedly.
Right.
And it's insane.
She wrote that book in 1949.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was still, you know, an ongoing process.
Right.
There's also quotes in this essay attributed to Mengele. For example, quote, "to fill their destiny as the chosen ones or chosen generations," end quote. No source.
Yes.
Doesn't give us a citation.
If you look down at the bottom, you can see Linda Hunt, of course, and she wrote Secret Agenda.
Right. He has source citations on some paragraphs, but the majority of what he says is completely unsubstantiated with no source.
Right.
You know, when he's talking about Dr. Green allegedly collaborated with the Germans during World War II and supposedly worked with Joseph Mengele, where's the proof of this Dr. Green bomb? He's saying supposedly. You know, where's the information?
Right.
And where's the proof?
That's in association, too, with Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien, which I've always kind of wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote Transformation.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, we have to be a little bit careful with some of that.
Yeah.
When somebody says that Joseph Mengele maliciously tortured and killed a small child in front of the other child during his programming,
mm-hmm.
he can be pretty leery.
Right.
In fact, we can say that's a lie. Come on. Like, he was this insane monster. It's nonsense. It's absolutely not. There's no proof whatsoever. We have to rely on one or two eyewitnesses who claim to have seen this. Who witnessed this? I want to know who is sitting there watching the two children. Was one of the children one of the ones? Obviously, it was only one of the children because one was viciously murdered. How did Mengele allow this other child to live on and tell of this story, to implicate him? What nonsense!
You know, the Germans have always been very kind, and during any kind of warfare, they're the ones that treated the people in the countries that they occupied with a lot of consideration. Mm-hmm. They were always very kind to the children. I just don't, their character is just
right.
not, conducive to murdering children.
Right. It doesn't fit the bill. And certainly not Joseph Mengele. He was a soft-spoken, decent individual. This man served as a doctor in the camp during the war.
Yes.
In Auschwitz. He wasn't some monster. He was a doctor
right.
who happened to have as his side research project, like every doctor has, genetics.
Yes.
And he took advantage of the fact that, wow, I have all these POWs and internees here. I'll take some blood samples and start doing a little of my side research.
And there are records of these blood samples.
Right. And drawing blood, is that a crime? I mean, well, then don't go to the San Diego Blood Bank or the your local blood bank. What nonsense.
Yes. And, you know, they have shown these records and said, oh, see, look at this medical record. And then
right.
when you get somebody that translates it, they say, oh, well, they were just drawing blood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was one alleged Holocaust survivor, who confronted one of the doctors. She showed him the documents. What is this? It's in her Eric Hunt's video. He says it's nothing. It's just a routine medical procedure.
Right.
It's nothing. This
right.
isn't some, you know, what nonsense. Poor man. I mean, I feel sorry for the doctor
yes.
that was confronted and accused like that.
Yes.
It's just nonsense. And then the guy goes on to mention Anton LaVey, Jewish founder of the Church of Satan, and his disciple, who apparently was in the CIA Psychological Warfare Division, which is quite scary, Michael Aquino. Basically, what's kind of pathetic about Anton LaVey is that he literally plagiarized the book Might is Right, and that is the Bible of Satan.
Oh,
so just go on to Amazon, purchase the book Might is Right. I think it's written under the pseudonym Ragnar Redbeard or something like that.
Uh-huh.
That is the Bible of Satan right there. And Anton just stuck on a couple little, here's my intro and here's my conclusion so I can make some money off this.
Ah.
Pathetic. Pathetic.
Yes.
So, I don't know what Anton LaVey has anything to do with the NSDAP. But he somehow worked him into the essay. And then we have Heinrich Müller mentioned. Nobody knows what happened to Heinrich Müller. Now, there was a series of books put out by a Douglas Clark or something like that about Gestapo Müller. Fake. They're all fake. Mark Weber and various other researchers at the IHR went through those meticulously, and they said, this is not, no, not real. So that whole series, now there are other people who swear by them, but the IHR and its researchers, including Friedrich Berg, said, no, they're fake. So the supposed diaries of Heinrich Müller that were handed over to this Douglas guy are disputed. And, you know, this guy doesn't even mention that. He just says that Heinrich Müller was a programmer in Monarch under the codename Dr. Blue or Gog. Says who? No source.
And no records.
Doesn't give us a source on that.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? And then the best one of all is this David E. Rosenbaum did a 9-year investigation from 83 to 92 and found Jerry Doty and Anne White, who are identical twins or twins, and they're Hitler's children. Isn't that incredible?
Well, isn't Angela Merkel one of his children?
Yes. Yes. Angela Merkel is also Hitler's long-lost daughter. This is a kind of nonsense. So ultimately, Hitler is MK Ultra. I don't know. This is just incredible. So I think we can pretty much discard that entire essay. And so we can move on to the pink swastika.
Oh, yes.
Which is the other problem that basically the entire NSDAP was homosexual. The whole party. He gets everyone in there. Okay, so we can start off. First of all, yes, Ernst Röhm was homosexual. Was he removed because he was homosexual? No. He was removed because the army, Hitler, and the SA were in a massive power struggle. And basically, the army met with Hitler on it was Blomberg. So he's the military personnel. He met with Hitler on a ship. Do we have a record of what actually took place there and what was said? No, that's super private. But the implications afterward tell us what happened. And we've gone over this before. Blomberg basically said, look, it's either the military and you as the president, chancellor, whatever, or you and Röhm and we attack you, take you out and probably kill you, Mr. Hitler. What's your choice? Okay, Hitler decided to decapitate, quote unquote, the SA. So that was when he purged Röhm, and that was the whole blood purge that everyone screams and wails about, which is really just the implications of a power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So the public was told it was because they were trying to cleanse the homosexuality, because how does one explain, okay, we're in this massive power struggle and I just basically had to tell the army that I want to be president. So, you know what I'm saying? That doesn't go over with the public.
Sure.
I mean, Hitler's not going to go before the masses and go, I want to be president or I want to be chancellor. So I sided with the army against my SA. That's what happened. And so we had to kill a certain number of these people. That just doesn't work that way. Maybe it should. Maybe our leaders should be more honest. Okay, we shot Kennedy because this.
Right.
Just tell us why. Because Johnson wanted to be president. Whatever.
Right.
But that's what's really going on behind the scenes. The masses are always told something else. Most of this particular essay by Scott Lively and Ken Abrams, I think these are just excerpts from their book, The Pink Swastika. It's all relying on secondary sources like Thomas Fuchs. You know, who are they citing?
Sure.
Probably more eyewitnesses and hearsay accounts, that kind of nonsense.
Right.
What's interesting is he does mention that Röhm was kind of into this community of the special. He abbreviates it CS. Because for some reason, homosexuals tend to be better warriors or whatever. Okay, Lume believed that. But what's interesting is research has shown that what started this didn't start in Greece, but it was a huge thing in Greece and probably also Sparta as well, that when homosexuals were sent out as the actual swordsmen and they went out in these square formations against whatever enemy, that they were more reliable and less likely to flee if they were fighting alongside their sexual partners and the loves of their lives. It's one of those strange things that, you know, it just happens to be the way human beings are.
Sure.
And so they were more reliable than heterosexual males. And so those people were preferred for combat.
And it was very common in those
very
times.
Very common. Oh, yeah. That's why everyone goes, oh, Rome, it was full of homosexuals and this and that. There is some merit to the theory that they are better soldiers. They made better soldiers. So, you know, that's one of those things.
Right.
Where
now wasn't there some sort of extenuating circumstances? Because wasn't Rome in jail? And I mean, he was hurt in World War I. Mm-hmm. And they gave him a lot of pain medication, so he had some addiction problems, and then he went to jail. And wasn't it in jail that he developed this propensity?
I've heard that, and that may well be true. A lot of straight men come out of prison bisexual or homosexual or even pederasts. So there is a process of kind of like a, I guess you'd call it kind of almost like a homosexual initiation when you're in the prison environment. And it may well have happened to Aristoium.
Yes.
So, yes. And I mean, certainly drugs may have played a part in that, the addiction to painkillers like morphine. So we don't know for sure. That's possible.
Right.
But it doesn't, just because people were associated with him in the SA or the NSDAP, namely Hitler, does not mean that they were also homosexual.
Exactly.
This is the problem these guys run into, is they're doing the whole correlation as causation. Well, if Hitler associated with Rome and they were close initially, Hitler must have been bisexual or homosexual himself.
Right.
No evidence points to that, of course. And if one just goes through all the records of Hitler and how many different things he is, was, and will always be, what I have concluded, and this is namely because I go back to, what's his name? Pootsie Hampfstengel, Ernst Hampfstengel. He goes, look, Hitler isn't bisexual. He's not homosexual. None of this stuff. He doesn't have any weirdness. No, he's asexual. Now, I think there's more merit to that theory than any others, because Hitler was one of those types of people who wasn't interested in that. He was interested in politics. He diverted his energies elsewhere, that was kind of on the side. Normal human activity relationship kind of on the side. And this is even verified by Eva Braun. So,
But they did have a relationship.
Exactly. And that's where somebody needs to actually read up on asexuality. It does not mean non-sexual. It just means that one is not sexually normal in the sense that other people are. And I'm using the term normal kind of just in in quotes, because what is normal will not necessarily asexual. That's not necessarily abnormal. But what I'm saying is he wasn't like a typical kind of family man into women as much. He wasn't. That comes through in every single memoir. And everyone's like, ooh, what is that? Is he homosexual? He must have some secret. No, it's none of that. And Hampfstengel, there's might be a couple others who have written memoirs, said it's pretty simple. The man was asexual. That's what they conclude. That did not dominate his life like it does normal, quote unquote, normal people. Hitler was a little different.
What is normal? Are we to believe that what we see on TV or in the movies is normal when this whole culture has been so sexualized and
exactly.
Women have been so, what is normal?
Right. And that's another thing. maybe we are so over-sexualized that it's so just every minute of the day kind of a thing, that that's promoted as normalcy, that we see Hitler as asexual. That could be another thing. It didn't dominate his life, so he must have been weird.
Right.
So we need to be a little bit careful with that. But I would definitely say that he diverted most of his energies elsewhere. It wasn't into the female-male relationship like most men. Hitler was a leader. And a lot of leaders have, like, real, true leaders who are trying to get something done and be active and not just, you know, like these Democratic elected goons.
Like the Clinton.
Who really don't care. They're off pursuing affairs instead of leading. They have to divert those attentions that would otherwise go to a relationship like that to leading. So.
Exactly.
That's all it was. That's all it was. And of course, Tom Stengel says that. He goes, his interests go elsewhere. It isn't in women, really. You know, and that's why Hitler, you know, he found Eva Braun, and that was great. He was totally into her. That's it. That's all I want. He didn't pursue affairs. He didn't really care about that. He found his one little woman who was of the same social rank as him. Boom, that was it. That was his love for life.
Yes. I mean, that's what I would consider normal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess because they weren't, you know, having sex every day, that wasn't normal. So it's just kind of that nonsense that everybody praised.
Oh, goodness. But the name, Pink Swastika, you know,
yeah.
And of course, the people who wrote this are Jewish and have
a... Jewish?
Yes.
That's right. And I mean, he just rattles off everybody. Captain Rohrbein, Captain Pannersdorf, Count Ernst Heldorf. Rudolf Hess, more than likely. Rudolf Hess.
Well, how do you, more than likely? Well, because he was in Germany, you know?
You know, I don't know, because Rudolf Hess was supposedly homosexual. I'm going, so what, was his whole family thing just a setup?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Everyone was homosexual in the NSDAP, according to these guys.
Yeah.
And they rely heavily on a Jewish historian who put out this work in 45. How did he know all this? Who knows? Samuel Igra. He wrote a book called Germany's National Vice and basically blamed everything on homosexuality. And he's the one that claims that Hitler was a prostitute during his Vienna years. According to who? I mean, who did this Igra guy go to?
Of course.
Probably Hitler's enemies, like Otto Strasser, head of the Black Front, who claimed that Hitler drew his niece nude and in various provocative, hideous positions. No, that was all invented. And that was exposed by, I believe it's Spots, author of Hitler and the Power of Aesthetics. He said, none of those drawings are Hitler's. They are all the drawings of a forger named Konrad Kujo, who was very good at forging Hitler's signature.
Amazing. Well,
he literally has hundreds of drawings and paintings that he has attributed to Hitler and sold as authentic Hitler's.
Oh, my.
And that those are some of them. The Gelirauble nudes are Konrad Kujo's drawings.
Well, you know, they have to discredit him in every single facet of his life. I mean, they referred to him as a house painter, a down and out broken down house painter when he, you know, he was an artist. He was very interested in buildings and architectural design, you know, but they have to diminish him in every single solitary way that they can in order to make all of the lies about Germany stick.
Uh-huh. Right. And I mean, this guy also relies on Langer, who wrote this psychoanalytic trash based on Otto Strasser's Black Front nonsense.
Yes.
All of those debaucherous claims about Hitler and his niece come from a fake diary of Hitler's alleged doctor. The man never even existed, exposed by Douglas and Bodding. I was Hitler's doctor. I can't think of the alleged man's name, but it is fake. It has an introduction by Strasser. Strasser and this non-existent doctor are the source of all of this nonsense that is not corroborated by anyone. And of course, Douglas and Bodding said, look, this diary was invented. This was never Hitler's doctor. So that's fake. If one wants to pick up I Was Hitler's Doctor, they can read that all that fake material in there and find where that comes from and see it with their own eyes.
Yeah.
And of course, Langer relies also on Rauschning. Hermann Rauschning was debunked years ago. So, you know, he met Hitler on a few occasions and exchanged a couple words with him. That was it. The man published, you know, pages and pages, an entire book of continuous dialogue with Hitler. It's all invented.
Wow. And that doctor was supposed to be what? Kurt Kruger?
Yes, it's Kurt Kruger. I Was Hitler's Doctor. Kurt Kruger never existed. That name doesn't exist. It was invented by somebody, probably Strasser. Or somebody affiliated with him. Some people have said it was Ernst Hofstengel that wrote under that pseudonym, but I don't think so. I suppose he could have under Allied coercion. He was in British custody.
Oh, sure. I mean,
so it's possible, but he never claimed he did. So.
Right. Very interesting.
And I mean, the guy goes through and says, was said to be bisexual, was said to be homosexual. So all these people are supposedly homosexual, but where's the evidence?
Right.
Says who?
And of course, once you introduce that, then pretty soon, you know, allegedly and said to be and purportedly, all of a sudden become absolutely and, you know.
Right. Yep. And according to him also, the supposedly Himmler was filmed, okay, in pederastic proclivities. No one has ever seen the film. Where is it? And who is Walter Frenz? NS filmmaker? Heinrich invites him on in to come videotape.
Right.
So Himmler allegedly has a quote-unquote sex tape out there. It's on film somewhere, but no one's ever seen it. No one's ever heard of it. Okay, show me. I want to see it then. Where's the proof?
Right.
And you know, none of that's ever shown.
He had 6 children, didn't he? And he was...
Himmler? I don't know how many children Himmler had. I know he had 1 daughter for sure. I'm not sure about him. Bormann had 9 children.
Whoa.
He's not implicated, though. Apparently, Bormann was normal.
Normal is
he wasn't homosexual, I mean. this is more just, it's pure hearsay, Jewish historians quoting Conrad Haydn, fellow Jewish historian who invented a bunch of lies about Hitler based on Strasser, etc., etc. And apparently the burning of all the garbage in the Institute of Sexology that was a Weimar creation, that was all just a front. Apparently, there was compromising photographs and information in there about NSDAP members. Mm-hmm. So the NSDAP burned it for that reason.
Oh,
not
sure.
Not because they were taking care of garbage.
My word.
Well, it would be like burning the material in the Kinsey Institute.
Yes.
Would anyone weep over that?
No.
I sure wouldn't.
No.
Or taking Hugh Hefner's collection of photographs and burning them.
Yeah, let's get rid of those.
Right. Oh, the horror. So one more thing in this. He says this all started, the disposing of the Jews, blah, 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 with Lanz von Liebenfels. According to H.W. Koch, who quotes Hans Doyerlein, he said that there is no evidence whatsoever that Hitler ever even read Liebenfels. None. Zero. So the whole Liebenfels thing, where the whole NS theory rests on that, prove it. These people have to prove it.
Yeah. Yep. It's pretty easy to put garbage out there, but.
Right. And it's hard to retract because people get the idea in their head. Well, I read it on the internet on this one. I swear I saw it. It has to be real.
Sure.
No, it doesn't.
Sure. It's like feathers in the wind. You know, you put all that stuff out there and it's out there for good. There's no collecting it back.
Exactly. And of course, as we know, Hitler and the NSDAP went after the Rothschilds and B'nai B'rith, so that is another myth exposed. They did go after Rothschild.
They really did.
People. Mm-hmm. And they seized their wealth.
Yes.
Their artworks and had them turn over steel mills.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You don't mess with the Rothschilds and not expect retribution for a long, long time.
Right.
Because the Rothschilds absolutely hold a grudge.
They do. And just one little peek into the future in our next program, we'll talk about it. But the Bank of International Settlement, Bank for International Settlements, Henry Morgenthau opposed that and wanted it brought down. So we'll go into why that was.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
BIS is so interesting.
Yes. He's got an interesting background. He and his father. Very interesting.
Morgenthau?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his father was the U.S. ambassador to the Ottoman Empire during 1915-1916.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, it's all convoluted.
Yeah. Yep. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this has been very enjoyable. And we'll have to do it again next week.
We shall.
Yes.
We'll cover the BIS.
Yes.
Some of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you're scheduled on the regular RBN program, too.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me as always. It's been a pleasure.
All righty. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.